Well, welcome to the Effie Bag Show, and we'll be here for the next hour. And of course, tonight being our end of season show, shall we say, tonight. But of course, join us as usual in the top left hand corner with a new hairstyle as well for everybody's Ali in the top left hand corner. How are we, mate?
Very good, thank you. Very straightened at the moment. Finally brushed it after about 6 weeks. So good.
bottom right, of course, Emily's with us as well. How are we, mate?
Hello, everyone.
She's cold, everybody, just so everybody knows.
And I'm of course, freezing, our
and a special guest, of course, tonight. Ali, over to you.
So, I mean, do I need to introduce you really, Sarah? So.
It'd be nice, yeah. No one knows who I am, and they're probably thinking, who's this woman? She does hockey and judo. This is football. Why is she here? So
I'm kind of thinking that myself at this point, but anyway. So basically, I've got a very, very good friend, a very amazing physiotherapist, and a lady of many talents. So this is Sarah Hart. So Sarah, over to you to introduce what you do, what you get up to, and what brings you with us this evening.
Hi, I'm Sarah. So I'm a sport physio and I work currently in judo and hockey, and I work in private healthcare as well. So Ali, well, I've just been following Ali's career obviously since she's been getting into football. And this whole podcast thing I think has been a really good thing that she's kind of set up, and she asked me to come on. And I kind of thought about it and I was like, I mean, I can, but like I say, I do judo and hockey and rugby and, you know, previously athletics and stuff like that, and one game of football, but I'm more than happy to come here. And that was covering for Ali.
I think I made you come to my game, didn't I, and cover me? And I went, I'm so sorry, Sarah, it's so different.
You did though. They were lovely guys, but I was so on edge through that whole game. I was like, I don't know what to do. And I think the thing that made it worse was I walked up to someone and I thought it was your manager and it was one of your players. I was like, oh, hi, I'm Sarah. I'm here to here to physio. And he's like, oh, okay. I was like, well, we need to go all the rest of it. And then when I realized I sat out like, or I was standing in the dugout, and then this other guy just walked past me, and I'm pretty sure he had like manager on his like pop. I was like, hi, I'm Sarah. I was like, oh, I was so embarrassed. I just stayed at the other end of the dugout the whole time. I was like, geez, gosh, they must have been coming out to amateur. So, yeah, that was my one foray into to football via Ali. So,
but sorry, she's done mate. Some,
no, thank you. But she's done me some favours by kind of covering some hockey matches for me as well. And
I was going to say, Sarah, I had the same experience when I covered them. You worked for Hampstead and Westminster. A bit of a mouthful, and I thought, okay, I'll go and cover you, so that's no drama at all. Bear in mind, I've always worked in semi-pro football, never done professional games. Turned up and I found out it was the Premier League hockey match against the team that were first and Hampstead the second. I went, oh my god, this is a really big deal, I was not prepared for this. I'm rattled, scruff.
But I felt if I told you what it was that you might have overthought it. I was like, no, it's just the hockey game. Yeah. Come along, there'll be a run for you afterwards, don't worry about that. Nothing to do with, you know, first versus second, and it's deciding, you know, points towards the end of the year for league take like places and stuff like that. You didn't need to know that.
No, I must have thought, it's 12 year old turning up being like baggy stuff and like my hair's all like this, going, I think I'm the physio covering today, which one of you is Hampstead?
Yeah, but you did all right. Like, I had very good reports off of you, Ali. Obviously, yeah. You know,
I hope so. I paid a lot of them off, to be honest, afterwards.
Ali, please tell me your physio bag is in better shape than it is at the moment.
Sarah's got more physio bags than me. Her bag is literally as big as me. Honestly, it is shocking.
That's fine, but I bet you it's tidy.
Sarah knows my bag.
Is chaos.
It's like my mind, though. My mind. Do you know what? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, the most intelligent minds are the most messy people, right? That's what I've always heard. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. Dave's nodding, which means I'm right, so that's fine. That's the way we're going to go with this.
I suppose as long as you know where stuff is, that's fine. But if someone's covering you and they're like kind of pulling stuff out.
You know me full well. No one ever covers my games because I'm never not there.
Do you know what? When I covered your game and then you never asked me back and I was like, oh God, I must have done a really bad job.
She did say that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
You know what it is? It's because Sarah, I mean, your sports are so different to mine. And I know Emily will love you for this. You're an ex-rugby physio, which frankly terrifies the crap out of me because for me, egg chasing is the most terrifying thing.
No slander.
I don't know what they're doing half the time. They're grabbing each other. The physio's running on for no reason. Sarah, how do you cope in rugby? Let's start there for a start.
Well, like, because I played rugby while I was at uni. I had a grasp of the sport. So I knew kind of what was going to go on, like if people went down and like kind of the rugby, the game and just the rules of it. So basically I'm a bit lazy when it comes to running on the pitch side, so rugby is perfect. You follow the game up and down, you never have to run from like the midpoint to wherever, you just only have to go across, and there were plenty of times where I'd watch a player go down and be like, get up, and then all of a sudden they just spring up. But also notorious with rugby, you get a lot of guys who maybe aren't in their peak of physical fitness and they'll just be down on the floor and they'll have to stop the game if you run on. And you're like, what's happened? They're like, oh, yeah, I just needed a breather. It's like, yeah, of course you did. Get off the pitch with me now.
So I've got a question to ask about the actual rugby. Because all this week, all I've been hearing about is the Lions. And mate, it's supposed to be such a big thing, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't give a monkeys. Do you know what I mean? It was like one of those things where I was thinking, why are they making such a fuss over something that they pick? However many players they pick, they go out, they get stuffed every time they go on tour anyway, and then they come back again. And I just like, I don't understand it.
This is slander, and I will mute you in a moment.
Well, seriously though, but when do they ever win? I think they've won once, haven't they? Once, drew the last one, won before that, and the other time they got stuffed every single time.
I think it's more about like going on tour and then like your fans going on tour with you. And I think it's like kind of a community thing. So I knew one guy who went to, I think it was New Zealand, the last one, and he basically hired a camper van, and it's such a big community that he basically, I think he just kind of put messages out to like various Facebook posts, and there were just like, he's just saying, just come and stay with us and we can go and watch the game together. And I think there's this big community that goes with the Lions side of it. Now, I'm going to be honest, I don't really watch it that much, but I get the community.
Someone mute there. Someone mute Dave and Sarah. Come on.
Say the magic word, Sarah. I've taught you what to say to Emily if she upset you.
I'm not going to say it, not just yet. But I did watch like the Six Nations, and I really enjoyed the Six Nations. Yeah. I thought it was great, and it was just nice to see some like sport being played more than anything else. It was great.
When I watched rugby, I do watch the rugby league, and I just think it's a great game to watch. Then I watch the rugby union, and I just think it's no comparison to me. It's just like chalk and cheese. It's just like the rugby league is so far superior; it's unreal.
Well, I wouldn't go that far at all. Rugby union is so much better.
I'll put this into context, Sarah. Dave sports Arsenal, so he doesn't really understand football either.
All right, fair enough.
But it's all about rugby union. Is all about cuddling each other. That's all they do.
Absolutely, there are some strong hugs that go on. I'm not gonna lie to you there. There really is, and it is quite a physical game as well. And you've got like, so I was a forward, so you're probably getting in there, you know, shooing people, pushing people over, scraping them with the boots of your, you know, the studs of your shoes. It happened, and then you'd ship it out as quickly as you could to the backs, and you expect them to basically belt down the wing and score a try. It didn't always happen when I was playing. It happened a little bit more when I was working in rugby. So I worked for London Scottish Rugby Club, which is down Southwest London. So first two seasons, I was doing a bit of work with the first team, but it was under another physio. And it was quite nice having that guide there, and you could see what they had to do on match days and how they interacted with like management and players and stuff like that. But then I would do physio cover for the third team, where it was then more my own team that I could then deal with. And I learned a lot there. And they went from National One to Championship. And when they went up, it was like a proper Hollywood ending, like London Scottish barking. Basically, whoever won went up. And we were down, I don't know, about 4 points. Then there was a line out at Barking's End. They were just about to score, had a line out. Ball got passed down the back's line and someone missed it, and one of our backs got it and basically sprinted the length of the pitch, put it down in between the posts. They got the conversion. London Scottish went up and Barking basically went into free fall after that point. The second season wasn't so great. We narrowly avoided relegation. So, you know, there was a yin and yang there when I was at that club.
The yin and yang of sport, I think, there's there, isn't it?
Really much. But the thing I'd see was you can see it was quite harmonious, and you girls are going to know this, that when you're doing well, everything's quite harmonious with the management team and all the rest of it. But then, like, the second season where it just, nothing really went our way, you could then start seeing, like, finger points going on and all the rest of it. Of, you haven't done this, this isn't being managed well, this isn't being done well. But I think the long and the short of it was we just, that they weren't good enough, like, when they moved up. And there was a real difference in the players, like the ones in the National Championship, well, no, National League, they're, you know, normal size. But Championship level, I've never seen people so big. Like, they were as wide as they were tall, and they were just physically strong. And I saw some really awful injuries in that season. Like, one guy got tackled twice really badly, perforated his bowel, had to have emergency surgery. And one guy, it was New Year's Day in Leeds. One guy came from the top of this guy's knee, one guy came from the bottom. And by the time they'd finished their tackle, this guy had torn three of his major ligaments in one knee and had a patella dislocation with it as well. It was grim. It was really, really grim.
This is why, Sarah, they'll be for me. Can you cover my games for me? I went, no, I'd rather not, to be honest, Sarah. I'm good.
I'm fit. You just put it off the pitch. But yeah, those kind of injuries were very few and far between. Absolutely. So yeah, that was kind of rugby, and I think I picked it because I looked at football. So if I want to go back even further before my physio degree, so I did sport rehab, and this was about 20 years ago, so it's a while ago. And the main goal was to be Newcastle United's physio stroke in the medical team. That's what I wanted, and if Alan Shearer was there, even better. But I think by the time I'd finished that degree, now I'm not sure how the rehab degree is set out now compared to what it was. There's no way that qualification would have got me into pro football at all. Just wouldn't have happened. And then by the time I'd finished sport rehab, I genuinely didn't want to work with sports people. I was just like, nah, this is not what I want at all. And then worked for a couple of years and I thought, actually, I do really want to do physio, but not really sport. And then obviously met you at UEL. And then I think a year into like being qualified, I was like, oh, yeah, I really should give sport a go. But I always wanted to find a sport where I'd have someone to be under, like a guide. Because I think, you know, we can talk about this a bit more if you wanted to later on. But when you see like these adverts go on UK sport of like, oh, come to this club, you'll get experience. And I'm like, no. No, that's not what you're getting. I say, if you're brand new qualified, that's an awful lot of, you know, responsibility to have on your shoulders. And I think new qualified people become two things. They either a bit like, they're not sure what they're doing, so they just go, yeah, just do everything and just let players go back on and it could be a risk. Or they do the complete opposite and just be like, oh, no, you've got a little bit of an injury, I think we should keep you off. And it's having that second person behind you to go, is this really what you think there should be going on? And I think having that soundboard, that's the experience you get in, not just someone going, oh, just work at a club, you'll be fine. That's not how it works. So I was always very much like, I always wanted to work under someone to begin with. So I saw the ropes basically. And then from there, I try and push on by myself. That's kind of how I got into the rugby side of it. And I, because I'd been at university around there, it was just easy, and I just knew the area. So it was quite nice to go back there now and again. So yeah. So that was rugby.
What's the difference between, would you say is the main difference then, physio wise? Is there a lot of difference between the sports that you know that you've done in football and hockey and rugby? Do you have to sort of manage the games differently than, you know, like the girls are doing football, but would you manage sort of hockey differently to football and differently to rugby, or is it all sort of almost the same?
I'd say it's pretty similar. I think the things, the kind of fundamental differences we have with, say, hockey and football is we have roll on, roll off subs. So we've got GPS trackers on all of our guys, and they've got a certain amount of minutes that they should be on the pitch for. And they go on for like 6 minute bouts or 5 minute bouts. So if anyone gets injured, it's really easy to get them off, assess, treat, and then decide whether or not they go back on without having to do like a proper full on substitution. And it could be a bit like that in rugby as well, that you had like someone who come off and then they go back on. I think that's kind of like the main difference, but ultimately you're looking at, can this person continue or can't they? And if they can, what are you going to do to get them back? And if they can't, what are you going to do to sort them out for like future games? It's almost like your management of that player starts there and then, of what you're going to do to get them back for future games, basically. So, and I think also with like, say, hockey and football, it's supposed to be relatively non-contact. We both know this is not true, but, you know, rugby, it is more of a collision sport. The rugby, I'd almost put into my work, we're doing judo, because that, again, it's quite collision, it's quite physical. So you'd almost kind of like put those two together, and then you could put football and hockey together, because I think those two would fall into that sort of bracket.
I mean, is it the same sort of, do you get the same sort of injuries as well with that, especially with hockey? I mean, hockey, I could see, you know, somebody getting the ump and whacking somebody around the back of the head with a stick and stuff like that. But I mean...
So I've never seen that, and that would be a straight red card.
I think that might be illegal.
I think, do you know, I did see there was one of our players who'd had really bad concussion injuries, actually, and it wasn't on one of my games, but I managed to watch it on a video, and the player I was managing at the time at club level, he got hit while playing for GB, and the guy who hit him or went for him, his stick was up very high, and I'm surprised he didn't get out. But yeah, his stick was up very high. And the only red card I've seen in hockey is for someone calling the ref basically a wanker to his face. And he got carded for that. And I was quite impressed that he even went up to the ref's face and said that. But they don't tolerate anything like that in hockey. Though you'd get in football, they're like, straight off, you're done. And he got either a six or an eight-week ban for that as well. So they do not tolerate that sort of stuff at all.
So what about you said about concussions there? I mean, how do the three, you know, so judo and hockey and rugby and football, how does that differ with the policies as well around concussion, concussion subs or a player coming on or off or whatever else for concussion?
Yeah, so if I come to judo first, so judo, it's very definite. If you've been... So you've been ippon, so you've been thrown on your back and you've gone into a whiplash injury and you've got concussed. So I had one kid, oh my goodness, and it terrified me a little bit. He'd been thrown on his back and I'd had to check his neck and that was fine. And I was like, well, I'm Sarah, do you know where you are? And he kind of just looked straight through me and he kind of looked down at his uniform, looked up at me and was like, I think I'm at the judo. I was like, yeah, you're off straight away. So got him, and then basically, if we're going through the stat form, so we have to complete like a form to check memory, recall, all this sort of stuff. If they're scoring high on certain things, we can kind of competently say they've got concussion. So if it gets worse, we tell them to go to A&E, but ultimately they've got to get checked out by a neurologist. So if we think they've got concussion there and then in a judo event, it doesn't matter if it's the last fight or the first fight, they're done. They're absolutely done. And that's it. There's a different policy for strangulation. So again, it's a bit grim in judo. So when you have the gi, you can pull it across like the neck and you can strangle them out. There's a separate policy for that, which I think a couple of our doctors were working on, because it's not quite the same as concussion. You're just trying to stop the carotid artery, basically. So we have that through judo. Now in hockey, basically anyone who has concussion and they're kind of scoring high on the stat, they're going to A&E and I want them cleared by a neurologist. Like, I won't let them back on the pitch until they've been cleared and we do the return to play as well. We've got like a format that we work through that's kind of come down from England hockey and it's on their guidelines. And I think the same kind of stands in rugby also, that there are guidelines that you've got to follow to get back people back playing their sport. The long and the short of it is I've seen people who've had concussion injuries whose like careers have been finished. That's it, they're done, because they can't get over the dizziness, they can't get over like the light sensitivity, they just don't, they're always quite sluggish, there's always this fogginess there. And we're talking people who've had really innocuous knocks, but that's it, they're done. And then there are other people who, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, absolutely fine, back at their sport, no problem. So I, you know, seeing what I've seen with concussion, it's something you just got to manage properly. Because if you don't, we're not talking sport, we're talking your life that it can affect. So I've had like one of the guys who, and this was the same one who got hit around the head in this tournament, this GB guy, and he was out like over a 3-year period for about a year and a half of it with concussion injuries and then concussion symptoms. He had to, so he was doing his third year at uni, he had to put it off for a year to finish because he couldn't concentrate on typing on a computer or reading books or using a phone, just couldn't do it. And it took him all that time to build back up, and it was awful actually. He managed to get back, he was just finishing his last year and he just finished his dissertation. And that night we had a game over in Lee Valley. And it was the last minute of the match. And he'd gone in for a challenge. And I think, I don't know if he turned awkwardly or whacked someone's hip or something like that. And he went down and I knew it was him straight away. And we took him to A&E. And like, I didn't want to be saying it because I wanted it to come from a neurologist because he was under one up in Birmingham in the end. But the A&E guy was like, have you ever thought about going into another sport or giving this up? Because it was getting to that point that he couldn't do it anymore. So yeah, that was it. And I think he did, he got back and then he managed to get another injury. I think it was like on the bumper cars at Legoland or something like that. But it was enough to be, that's it. He was done. And, you know, he reached a very high level in like a junior and then, you know, youth setup. But that was it. That was it. It was his career done. So when I look at what happens in football, I'm going to be honest, it's very behind the curve of like the way I've seen it managed in hockey and rugby. And I appreciate it's a new thing that's being managed in football, because I get it. I do get it, because, you know, you've had a generation of people who have just like, oh, you'll be fine, don't worry about it, just crack on, it's not a problem. And those people probably did have real bad issues or that fogginess or that slowness, but they didn't know what was going on, they didn't realise what it was. And I think now there's more and more data coming out to support this sort of stuff and support people, you know, taking time off of work or rehabbing, or, and it could be down even to just checking like blood, heart rates, and making sure you don't go over a certain heart rate with your exercise. It's those sort of things that you need to be kind of considering when you're in the football environment. But it's playing catch up to the sports that I work in. Absolutely. Yeah.
Why do you think that is though, Sarah? Why do you think they are so far behind?
I think there probably wasn't the acknowledgement that there was a problem in the first place. They were thinking, well, it's not a collision sport, so you don't have these sort of problems.
But I think the reason football is so far behind is because of Terry goddamn Butcher. Everyone, anytime you have a head injury, they're like, Terry Butcher played on. It's like, what? Give me a break.
Exactly. And in all fairness, he shouldn't have played on because that was a blood hazard as well.
Screaming down his face, heaven's sake.
Yeah. But that
bloodshirt.
Exactly. That was of that era of like, no, just get on with it. Just get on with it. You're fine. Don't worry about it. And I think now at least you're getting a lot more literature out there that's saying, well, actually, you need to look at this. And now one of the girls who I used to work with at Hampstead, and she worked at London Scottish, and she's actually a rugby osteopath, and she's doing a PhD all about concussions within championship rugby. And it's kind of all supporting like this whole collision thing and the management afterwards, because I think until it's taken seriously by like your bigger teams, it's not going to filter down to like your lower league stuff. And then, you know, your championships or your national leagues or whatever, it's got to be taken seriously at the top.
I think at the moment though, they're doing a lot of research into football and injuries from like players who played in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So I think obviously the balls were a lot heavier and stuff. And obviously, like you say, concussions weren't managed correctly. And it was only, I realised on the Jack Charlton documentary, obviously Jack Charlton died from, he died with dementia. Yeah. His brother has now been diagnosed with dementia. And there's a lot of players who played in the 66 World Cup who had and have dementia. And there's a big, big kind of research going on at the moment to see what the repercussions of the footballs, the head injuries, blah, 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 are. But like you say, it's light years behind.
Yeah, but, and I think rugby also look at stuff like, you know, when it comes to tackles and stuff like that, they'll only have it in certain age groups that you can do certain tackles. And in judo, like there's certain moves, so like that whole strangulation thing I was talking about, you can't do that until you reach a certain age. And what you're actually trying to do in like the judo, because it is, it's quite a, you know, not violent, but it's quite a forceful sport. But what they teach the kids to do first of all is they teach them how to get out of certain movements or how to land properly. So if you know what you're doing there, then it's not going to make it easier, but you know, if you're going to get thrown on your back, you're going to get thrown on your back, and you know how to then land properly, if that makes sense. So it is almost that kind of preemptive side of it. And I know they've looked into like football about like reducing the amount of headers that you do and things like that, but
how long do you, I mean ladies in general, how long do you think it'll be before maybe we get to a stage where they ban heading of the football, they ban this, they ban that? Because you know, it's getting to that stage, isn't it, where we've got the concussion situation going on in, which is, as you said, is really good in rugby and other sports, not so good in football. But all of a sudden, then when do they start looking at dementia? You know, my mother-in-law passed away from it. You know, which has put my wife and other and the girls in that high risk category as well. But when do they start looking at that? Do you think and going, well, hang on a minute, we've got to look at that as well. In, you know, in rugby, and will there be tests, especially something like rugby, I would have thought, will there be tests going forward that after a certain time that they'll be able to see the early signs of it as such, if you know what I mean? That they,
I know football started looking a little bit towards grassroots or children's football and heading the ball, as in, I think Alan Shearer, your mate, Sarah, did an excellent documentary on dementia and looking at almost like your CTE sort of stuff that American football been very far behind on and now catching up with. There's been a lot of looking at sort of repetitive head injuries or repetitive heading of the ball and what damage that may cause. My gut is that there'll be a change in the next 5 years of kids' football. Will adult football ever change? Probably not until there's a big injury, I reckon. I mean, they like to wait till there's been a problem, sadly. I thought we had one with Tongan a few months back, didn't we, when he come off and he was vomiting everywhere, but he was still fit to play a week later. I think until that's sorted out, you have to question when it will come down to sort of the whole of football.
But I mean,
we need a bad injury first, sadly. I hate to say it because I wish we didn't have to have that moment to happen, but I think we need a big bad injury for there to be a change.
I mean, one of the sports as well that, you know, that that seems to me to be a sort of a violent sport, but also gets to the stage where when I do watch it, you see how quickly the doctors and the physios or whatever get into there to actually get to them. Is stuff like that UFC. And I don't know if any of you actually saw this weekend's one when a guy got hit with a reverse elbow. And I think it was only the third time ever or something that somebody had been knocked out from it. Well, I'm telling you now, I'd still be knocked out from it now. Do you know what I mean? And that was like on Sunday. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was just unreal. But, you know, the referee straight away, I mean, literally before the bloke had hit the floor, the ref had called it off. And, you know, and within about 2 seconds, whoosh, there was a doctor in there, there was a physio in there, there was, and it was literally within seconds. But you see stuff like boxing and stuff like that, where you, that doesn't necessarily happen that quickly.
I think boxing's changed a lot. If you used to watch the, I mean, big Muhammad Ali fan, if you watch the old school fights, the guys used to get the bow bells knocked out of them quite frequently for a long period of time. But what they did in boxing, they established that to make weight, a lot of people were not drinking, they were sort of dehydrated, which is very bad for your brain, unfortunately. Which is one reason why they moved the weigh-in further away from the fight itself, so that way you can allow them to, you know, make weight and then rehydrate nice and quickly afterwards. I think boxing leads the way on concussion, because the whole point of your sport is to potentially try and knock somebody out, or at least try and render them so they won't knock you out. I'm a big fan of boxing. I know people don't like it, but it is an art form. And I think that it's the art of defence and offence when you're doing things. I think that football's got a lot to learn from things like boxing. I mean, I think boxing takes it so seriously now. I think you get the odd bad occasion when you see a really bad one slip through. You see the amount of people in boxing go, that was wrong, it shouldn't have happened. I think UFC's another one where they're just so hot on it, because the last thing you want is somebody to get seriously injured and or die, because that's what a head injury could do. I'm sure Sarah would agree with me. I mean, I think you had a nasty one. It wasn't particularly a head injury, but more of a gentleman in hockey who had the eye injury, which is pretty shocking in itself. I think that these people don't always realize, particularly in football, sadly, I think, that they don't always realize how serious these things can turn, what they can turn into. It's not just a knock on the head, you know?
But are you surprised then that football don't actually sort of knock on the door of rugby union, rugby league, and knock on the door of this one, knock on the door of that one, UFC, boxing, and they don't get together with these people and say, well, how do you cope with a concussion? What have you got any ideas on how we can cope with it in our sport compared to your sport? And have some sort of, because it just seems to me that it's all, is it a bit blasé? Oh, yeah, well, we'll just do that. Do you know what I mean? We just, it doesn't seem to be taken seriously.
I'd like to think that the medical teams around football are looking across to what rugby or whoever boxing are doing and kind of, you know, taking that to the FA and to look at it. But I mean, I've seen your arguments about the whole VAR thing, and I the way that VAR is used in, say, hockey is you have a referral every half. If your referral turns out right, bang, you keep your referral. If it turns out wrong, you've lost it. And it goes in tennis as well. And I still don't understand that you've got all this technology and it can be just so applied so cack-handedly. And again, I think it comes down to, maybe it's a bit of an old boys club going, no, we don't need to worry about this. And even though I think the medical teams are probably banging on the doors about this, it is a bit like Ali says, until you get that big injury that you've got to kind of sort out and it highlights it. And I think that's what's going to kind of push the concussion side of it maybe a little bit more.
But there, you hit the nail on the head there with the gentleman's club and the old boys club, and that it's fine, just get on with getting on. That's exactly, at every level in football, that's exactly what it's like. Yeah. And it's just, even at our level, like, clubs are so narrow-minded and short-sighted as to how they can improve. And it's like, it's a bit scary at times, but like you say, you'd like to think that higher up the ranks, where people have the top medical teams, that they are being listened to.
Yeah. And I think also, if you're also looking at the kind of concussion protocols that they were looking at, was to have like an independent doctor at each match. To kind of look at these players and all the rest of it, because they weren't, I think you were talking about, was it the Spurs player who was sick and all the rest? They were like, well, you should have an independent doctor here. And I was like, well, that's fine, because I think there should be one. But again, they're not looking at it. They're thinking, well, I've already got a medical team here. We've already got that medical team over there. Why do we need someone independent? And then I think it just becomes this kind of whole like free-for-all, and it should be the medical team should be taking care of the players properly. Now, I can't talk about what happened in that Spurs thing, because you know, you sometimes you can not have the symptoms of a concussion and all of a sudden you can have them. So I don't quite know what's gone on.
So my question would be then, around non-league football, as we're talking about that now, I'm just going to say a really silly question to ask, and it might be a really simple answer from all three of you. Say, for instance, tomorrow someone's looking for a physio, and I turn around and go, yeah, okay, I'll come down. And I just walk down to the game, and whoever the game may be, and I go down and I physio. Is there any checks within the league and within the clubs that you are what you say you are? Because, you know, is it a case that I could go, you know, when you see these people advertising for, you know, if you've got, I need a physio for so-and-so night, and I know the girls get the ump about it, and rightly so, they, you know, they don't want to pay them for it and stuff, but let's go down there, I need a physio for this night or whatever. Someone I says yes, and you've never heard of them.
I hadn't even had my meeting with my manager. I walked through the gates of Phoenix and the secretary stopped me. He's like, I want your qualifications. I was like, I'm here to talk to the manager. He's like, yeah, I want your qualifications. I was like, fine. I hand over my qualifications.
And that's my question. Did they ask you for the qualifications or did I just...
And I was walking through the gates. Yeah. I was like, okay.
You do look a bit shifty though, Ems. I'd probably check the qualifications too, mate.
They're off the back of a cornflakes box.
Some clubs don't ask, Dave.
Some clubs don't. They don't care. They just want someone to stand on the sideline with the bag. They don't ask. They don't care.
Whereas most clubs should and do ask.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is should that be a case? And should there be a law in football, rugby, hockey, whatever it might be, you know, that these people have got to be qualified. I know you might say, oh, you've got to have a qualified physio. But if people and clubs are not actually checking, how do they know? I mean, as I just said, I could go down and do a game then tomorrow and not have a clue. What I might have is a bucket of water and a wet sponge. Do you know?
That'd be controversial for a second, Dave, just for a change.
Yeah, go on.
I think everybody should know about concussion. It's not just down to me. I might be in the toilet for 10 minutes when something happens. Who knows? You know, I might have just left to go and do something. I might be dealing with a really bad injury. I might have gone in the ambulance with a player. I think management, I think players themselves should know. I think everybody in football, relatively speaking, should be able to do a small, either a basic first aid and or throwing a bit of concussion in there as well. Because the more knowledgeable we are as a sport, the better we manage it. So if a player understands, actually, my concussion might lead to A, B, C, D, they'll think twice. I tell you what, players are so hot on now on ACL injuries. They all know exactly what the symptoms are,
yeah,
how long they'll be out for. So if any player I know does a little twist, like, oh, Ali, my ACL, check, Ali, do that test you do when you pull my knee a bit like this. So when they want to be knowledgeable, players understand what the risks are. I think you've got to educate them and you've got to empower that player rather than just be like, oh, Ali will decide.
So you saw it firsthand at that boxing match with that girl. I can't remember her name, and she fractured her eye socket in the end. The x-ray showed the fractured eye socket. But she went to her corner on a number of occasions and said, I can't see. Mm-hmm. Her coach didn't stop the fight. The ref didn't stop the fight. There's a lot of people there that could be held accountable because that's so dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's so dangerous.
So if someone can't see,
they should not be allowed to fight on.
So I've always said that when you see like youth football, and they say now to run a kids team, you've got to have at least a level one. So I've always said, for me, even some of these managers, and you see some of the managers, I'm just pulling names out of the hat. I'm not saying what I'm about to say is about them, but people like, you know, Danny Chapman at Harlow and Tony at your place and your manager at your place, etc., etc.
His name is Paul.
Paul, all right.
He's gone now, David. Tony's gone. Stop reminding me.
What I'm trying to say is. Sometimes, and even when you see in the games, they're calling up on calling a referee, and ref, why ain't you done that? But they've not been trained as a referee to know what that decision and why that decision's been made. So I've always said that when they go in for their training sessions, they should, you know, as part of their coaching badges, there should be a referee's course as part of that coaching badge. So should there then also be, as part of their level one, especially in youth football, should there be a physio or at least have a kind of a medical thing there? Because you have to go in there and show and do like the heart stuff.
It is part of your level one.
Yeah, but
it was when I did mine.
Yeah, but you know what I'm trying to say? When you do your level one, I do my level one, and all that realistically is level one. It's just resuscitation, and that's about it.
Exactly, so, I mean, David.
But it's basic first aid, but it is part of your level one.
But you know what I'm saying? There's no concussion. So if one of those kids there goes and clashes heads, they don't know if that kid's got a concussion or not. They just let him carry on playing as soon as he stops crying, don't they? Do you know what I mean?
I'll be so fair, David. That be part? Yeah, Sarah, please don't shout at me and or report me to the HCPC for this comment.
All right.
Right?
Well.
This is my biggest bugbear in physio. We all get obsessed about CPR, about resus, about defibs. You are 125% more likely to meet a head injury, a serious fracture, even an, probably even an anaphylaxis, to be honest with you, the meat, an unconscious, essentially dead player on your pitch, sadly. That's the way it works. So we do all this thing about teaching, and it's important to learn about resus and CPR. It's very important. Life-saving is the most important thing you're going to learn in resus. But you should also learn about things like head injuries. In my career, I've touched wood. I've only ever had to get a DP about once, and I didn't use it because, thankfully, the player didn't stop breathing and his heart didn't stop. I've seen countless head injuries. Some I've caught, some I haven't caught. You know, some were three pitches long, I had to run across and go and deal with it. I think in terms of like likelihood of meeting a head injury, it's likely. So therefore, why are we not teaching this? Do you see what I mean? And it's incredibly controversial because everyone thinks, oh, basic first aid is going to be pumping on the chest, singing Staying Alive, whatever song comes into your mind at the time. For me, we really have to get heads on with head injuries, with bad cuts, with things like how to deal with those things you're going to see every single day, because it's more likely you're going to get a ligament injury or fracture, let's be honest. I think as a coach, I'd say if you've got a player who's not breathing, the first thing you've got to do is get help, because all of us can only do CPR for, 2 minutes a max? I don't know how many of you guys you can do it for, but I do about 2 minutes max when I've been doing it in the hospital. And even then, I'm knackered. Like, realistically, the worst injury you're going to get on a foot pitch is probably a head injury. That's the one I personally, the physio, I fear the most, because it's the one that can change very quickly.
Yeah.
It's head injuries and anaphylaxis. I think they're the ones that are going to be really bad for me to manage, because they're going to change in minutes. Yeah. If I don't do the right thing at the right time, I've got a problem on my hands. Do you get what I mean, David? It's controversial, because people always go like, oh, no, you've got to have a defib sitting next to you on the pitch.
Yeah.
I've got to have a backpack sitting there personally.
I do make sure I've got everything with me, but the point of the matter is, like, and we had this discussion when we spoke to Steve Bennett way back when, like, I'm so passionate about head injuries. Like, I didn't obviously realise who Steve... Do you know who Steve Bennett is, Sarah?
No, who's that?
So Steve Bennett's a referee, but he's refed at, like, the top, top level. He's refed Champions League. He's refed Wembley FA Cups. He sent Ronaldo off 3 times. And I have marched up to him. Not asked. Told him that if there's a head injury, I won't be waiting for him. I'll be going on. I'll be just... And he was like, okay.
But you mentioned about the defibs and that. So when you go into these groups, when you go to a game, and I think you might be a bit different with the Dons, because don't get me wrong, they look a little bit more like park pitches than stadium pitches. So when you was doing it with Cray and yourself, Emily, with Phoenix, and Sarah with your clubs as well, you do your stuff with, is one of the first things when you walk into that ground is to know where that machine is.
Yeah.
I know exactly where it is, know where the stretcher is. It's important to know, it's like a little check. When you go in, as a physio, you go in and go mentally, go, okay, right, this is where the ambulance will come in. This is where my defib is. This is where my stretcher is. This is where I can get fresh water from. This is where I'm going to be sitting. This is the other physio I'm going to be working against. You kind of get an idea of what's around it. I mean, I also used to look up where the local hospital was, because odds are I'm going to drive the player to the hospital most of the time, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Because ambulances take 4 hours and it takes too long to be in the cold, in the rain, unless it's that bad you can't move them, which, touch wood, again, I never had it really. I think you have like a little mental checklist of what you know, what needs to be where, and then you feel, I always feel personally more secure knowing that this is what's where. I know Emily will contest about my bag being messy, but I know what, I check it, make sure I've got everything I want in there, and it's all in easy reach, because odds are I'm going to throw it all out when I'm going to put it in if it's that bad. I'm not a Cray anymore, sadly. But we had a player who had an anaphylaxis. I know, I mean, so I've got his jabbers in my bag, so I'm ready to go, because that's probably most of the serious injury I'm going to get on that pitch that day. So you kind of have those little things ready to go for serious injuries, but you hope never to use them. That's what I always think. You know it's there, but I don't want to use it.
So then I've got, like, probably then the next level.
You have. You mean your level is another level up from us, to be honest. So your bag was bigger than me. I could have got in your bag and stayed there for a couple of days. It was lovely.
So, yeah, I think I've grown as a physio, and you can see the evolution of my bag as well. So when I first started, it was one of those small little run-on bags, and now it is a travel case. And so I have a red emergency bag, which is all airway management, blood management, all the rest of it. Then I have a black bag, which is all my physio stuff, mat, crutches, box splints. So I've got a couple of those, everything. But then I also have, and I do it every season, I have a normal operating procedure and then an emergency action plan that gets sent out to all the management. And it's basically like the normal operating procedure is, okay, this is just how it runs. If someone gets an injury, this is how I update the players, this is how I update the management. Do I need to send stuff off to, like, you know, if they're high level, so they're under like GB or Wales or whoever, I just need to let their you know, other physios or doctors or whoever know. So I have that, but then I have an emergency action plan as well. So if in an emergency, right, here is where the defib is, here is where the ambulance come in, and it's all kind of put out on a sheet, and I send it out at the beginning of the season. I print off another copy, it's in the bag. So it's all there ready to go. So if for whatever reason I'm not there, or someone doesn't quite know what they're doing or doesn't know how to direct the ambulance in, I'm like, just pull it out, it's there, you can just get the picture out straight away. So they will know. And then I do have a list of the local hospitals next to all. So you just do this. I've got a list of all the hospitals where we go to play, whether it's like Nottingham or even down to Surbiton. Like, we've got a list of, right, this is the hospitals, this is the UCCs around this area if I don't want to go to A&E. And yeah, it's that kind of level we have, that I kind of picked up from like the stuff I've done in judo, the stuff I've done in rugby. And I got fortunate enough to go to like the Commonwealth Games, like in Glasgow as well, and you just saw like the management of all these things. And half the time it's all about just getting that player off the pitch quickly and as safely as possible, and then working out what to do next. But if you can't, tough, you have to leave them there, and then you have to make sure the ambulance comes to you and you give them the right details at the right time. So I think what I found was doing, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, Ali, like if you think about the sports like first aid course we did when we first did UEL, it was like a day course and it was all about airway management, and that was it. And then I convinced you to come on to this lupus trauma course, which was 2 days, quite pricey, but it is, you just practice again and again and again of fracture management, airway management. We talk about anaphylaxis as well. And it's great because when they do their kind of airway management, they go, right, look, you know what you need to do. It's half an hour on the first morning. This is it. And they just watch you do like the compressions, they watch you do that. But the rest of it is practicing, working in a team, getting someone off the pitch, you know, making sure something is stable. It's all those sort of things as well. And they talk about, like, you know, if a patient goes off, what do you do? If they've got a head injury, what do you do? It's all those kind of scenarios that you practice again and again. And I found, like, in judo, we, like, the amount of spinal extractions that we've done, so it's a little bit like your UFC stuff. So, you know, talking about earlier that you have an injury and they're straight on there. And half the time that's down to the refs, because the refs are watching. They're watching the eyes of each player. They're watching what they're doing, because it's the refs. It's down to the refs to be really hot on this stuff. And it's the same in judo. So when someone's getting strangled out or when someone's getting arm locked, the ref is watching, because as soon as they see anything, they'll call us straight on, because we can't go on there unless it's like a really significant injury. We can't go onto the judo mat until the bout has finished or something's happened. The judo part, like umpires will call us on. So, and then once we're there, we're there within like seconds, because you have tables set at the end of each of the mats. We're there, and then we've got, you know, we have an orthopedic, we've got three orthopedic doctors on our team. We've got a GP, we have four physios that work there as well. And what they call paramedics. And that's our team that we have each and every like weekend that we do like national tournaments. And that's been like that for the 8 years that I've been working in judo, is that we have to have that sort of team. We have to have an ambulance on site. Now, when I'm at Hampstead, nothing like that at all. It's just me. And I've got to use my ideas and my kind of self-reliance to know what I can and what I can't do. And if I need any extra help, like, we've got a couple of the guys, so one or two of the guys, they do work in the NHS, or they know basic first aid, which I know I can always call on. But it's down to you. And I think, Dave, what you were saying about, like, you know, about the club's check-in, about whether you're qualified or not. Well, the club can check. So for physios, we've got the HCPC register. I'm guessing sports therapists and sports rehabbers have something similar. But even though you're checking that someone's qualification, that's not really the most interesting thing. It's more, are you covered? Like, do you actually have like your coverage? And then do you have like a decent trauma qualification that goes with it that you can deal with this? Because ultimately, if anything kind of goes wrong, it could fall down on the physio. Have they practicing outside their, or the therapist or the rehabber, are they practicing outside their remit? Did they make a duff call because they don't have that trauma training? So this is why this is another bugbear of mine, of people saying, well, you just come along for experience. I'm like, no, you're just taking the pressure off yourself here. You can kind of put it on someone else if they make that sort of decision. So I think that's kind of what I find with like trauma management. And it's very different what you're doing on your own compared in a team. But it's then knowing your place within the team, but then also knowing what you can do as an individual. And there's going to be times where you're going to feel really, really helpless, but you've just got to do the best that you can and pray that that ambulance gets there as soon as possible.
I'll tell you when I last felt helpless, Sarah, on that Lubus course, doing a bloody sling. Honestly, I hate slings. I'm rubbish at them. Do you know what? I've worked in A&E. I've worked in resus for years. I can put an MP airway in. I can do all the jazzy stuff. Give me a sling. I'm like, what is this thing?
Just put a knot in one corner and then...
It sounds so stupid. The second one to me, put a knot in one corner, went, and that done. Like, oh, I've never known this in 10 years of working in A&E. And I never knew about putting a knot in a sling. That's the sign of what a good course is, though, isn't it? You get a little tidbit like that.
Absolutely. So two questions, if I can. One is, sort of linked in with the first question, do professional physios that are on the touchline, maybe your level there, Sarah, in the higher sport, etc., do they have a defib that they carry with them? And secondly, also as well, if you three ladies are all physios in the Isthmian League, and Nick Robertson all of a sudden turns around and says, right, we're going to have a physio meeting where I'm going to answer questions or whatever else, have a think tank with the board at the Isthmian League. What would be the one sort of things that you would say, girls, that you would want to ask him and also put into effect, say, for the beginning of season 21-22?
It's a big question, David.
So what about DFibs? Do professional physios have that DFib with them? So like Premier League wise and stuff, do they have one there? Or
They've normally got cover, haven't they, Sarah? If I remember correctly, a lot of them have like a separate back paramedic cover at the game anyway. So they've probably got a DFib. The clubs have probably got about six around the ground for the fans, let alone for the team.
Yeah.
They're amazingly well covered DFib wise.
Absolutely, because generally speaking, if it's a general, like a public place, you've got to have a DFib for a certain amount of people that are going to come in. So all the places that I've kind of worked at or been at, there's always been DFibs around. They might not necessarily be right next to you, but as long as you know where they are, whether you go off and get them or you decide you're going to work with the patient and they go off and get them, that's something that you then decide at that point. But I think the moment you see someone down on the pitch or on the side, it's one of the things you just would instinctively go and get as a just in case, because if you don't need it, you can just go and put it back. It's not a problem. So I think from like a pro sports side of it, they certainly have like the equipment there, but it's that kind of level where it's not quite like Sunday league and maybe it's not quite professional. It's that bit in between where, you know, people aren't quite sure where stuff is kept or what they should be taking, or maybe there's not the finances in the club to actually have the DFib there and keep it going. So I'll tell you what, one of my friends, she works in rugby and the police needed the DFib for, like, I don't know, we were catching someone and I think he ran across train tracks and they needed the DFib, it was at her club. So they went to go and get it, but they couldn't actually get in. Like, they tried the code, didn't work. And then when they got it, they tried to use it. And what happened is someone had cut through the wires during the renovation. So this DFib was dead. So even though there was a DFib there, it was just no good. So I think sometimes also thinking that, yeah, you've got to get that DFib, but equally you've just got to make sure you're managing it well at the same time and just know where other DFibs are. So, and like Ali was saying, like, I've never, touch wood, had to use a defib. Like, I just haven't. But it is the kind of bigger injuries, like the fractures, like the nasty head injuries that I would see more often. I think, I don't know how it feels. I mean, it is a bit different when it comes to, I guess, rugby with football. But, you know, if we have an injury in hockey, in hockey, but I'm given time to go there, quickly assess that patient. I don't have an umpire coming buzzing in my ear or ref going in my ear going, we've got to carry on. I'm like, mate, I'm trying to do my job here. And if you just back off, I can do that. We don't get that. We're given space to sort things out and get people off. And it's the same in judo as well. We're given that space. So I don't know if that's what you necessarily get in football, but that would be the thing I would ask, is just give the clinician there, or the, you know, just that space to kind of assess of like, right, what's going on? And then try and get them off the pitch if you can, but to take your time. And I think sometimes when people feel rushed, especially if they're at the beginning of their career and they've come in for a bit of experience, they're going to try and move someone when they really shouldn't be doing it. So I think just giving that person that time to assess and understand what's going on, that would be what I would be looking at if I was going to like your meeting at the ECN League.
I had exactly what, Sarah. I've been doing this game a long time, and I had a bad injury for the Dons the other in midweek about 2 weeks ago, and I won't mention the ref's name because he nearly got a boot thrown at him at the time, but he was in my ear the whole time, and this the poor lad thought he'd done his. In hindsight, quite a bad. I know we discussed it really outside of this meeting, Sarah. He had quite a bad injury in hindsight, and yeah. The guy was crying. He was quite upset. The player. He was in bits because he's just come back from an ACL in the last year, and he thought, oh God, here we go again. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to. You know what? At that point, I didn't care about the game. I didn't care about a stretcher. I didn't care about any. I wanted this to calm him down and say, it's okay, mate. Have a big deep breath. Ali's here now. It's all going to be fine. Can you, do you feel able that I can move you before we get anybody else on this pitch? And all I needed really was the ref to just take maybe like 2 or 3 metres away and just let the situation calm down a bit.
Yeah.
Which I thought I didn't really get. I mean, luckily, my chairman ran on at the time and a few players who were supporting him helped get him off in the end. But I feel like it's a little bit of compassion in an injury moment. Absolutely. You know, horrible being injured. I wouldn't want to be injured, you know.
So what would you say to...
Set your expectations early with the ref.
I mean, to be honest with you, I just expected better of him, if I'm being wholeheartedly honest, Em, sadly. I'll leave it there.
Well, he won't be on next week, you're sure. Let's just put that there.
I had my mum didn't see who it was, didn't know who it was. I thought, oh God, this is awkward, isn't it?
After poor old.
He's blacklisted now, he's upset, Ali, that's it.
Yeah. Poor old Steve. Anyway, right, he's taking pelters in here tonight. But in all fairness, I suppose one of the final questions, Nick Robinson phones you, invites you to the meeting. What's the one thing that Emily and Ali and Sarah are going to say to him, right, we need this put into place for next year. This is something that needs to happen.
I echo what Ali and Sarah have said about, obviously Sarah enjoys the luxury of time with her referees.
Amazing.
But I echo what Ali said about like refs just giving you a bit of space. It feels like you've got about 15 seconds to assess and they're like, excuse me, what's going on? And I also think the league should not inform refs they're being assessed because that's when it all falls to shit.
Mm. But I'm talking about physio-wise. So what would you say physio-wise? What would you say to... Is there something that bugs you about, you know, non-league football that you would say to them, look, this is something that you need to go to the FA to see if we can get changed. We need this situation to happen.
I think it'd be lovely. I mean, one's a wishy-washy one and one's a bit of a personal one. I think one for me would be around having good mentors in football. So I think that, me and Sarah we met at uni. I don't want to say many years ago now, Sarah. but we had a very different journey in sport. I went straight into football and did it on my own. And Sarah almost became my mentor to an extent of me going like, oh, Sarah, what do you think of this? And how do I manage this tendon? And what does that do? And, you know, what do I do if this is happening? And she kind of, I mean, my sounding board. I would love to have people from clubs higher up almost sort of keeping an eye out and mentoring those at lower clubs and maybe giving them experience. Because I think ultimately a lot of young people get into old in football, particularly at lower level, to go up and climb. Now, yeah. My climbing days are gone, I think, sadly. But I think that it'd be lovely to have that natural progression of saying, like, actually, you know what? Ali's working at, let's say, my old club, Fisher. So I'm going to... Oh, I've got to say it. maybe the Millwall physio might go, you know what, we're your local club, we'll keep a little eye on you. You can come down, spend a day, once we have a month, do a bit of training of us. You can come and see our facilities, or, you know, oh, we've got some spare tape this month, why don't you have a little bit of that? Or we're going to get, we got to deal with this place. I think it's good to have those connections up and below, particularly for like sport. Look at the physio societies for getting your points and getting your badges and getting up to gold level of the, is it the physios in sport?
Yeah.
It'd be great to get those links again, because I mean, I think a lot of people are quite protective in sport about getting you in. I think if I'm being wishy-washy.
But I think they're protective about getting you in because they're worried about that you're going to take their jobs.
Yeah.
that's the long and the short of it. Because if you've got a job like, oh, they work at Liverpool, well, I fancy that, and you do everything you need to do, and they're a bit like, well, I don't know if I really want to mentor them because I'm worried they'll take my jobs. But that happens in all walks of life, that you get this lack of mentoring sometimes.
Can I just say, Sarah, one thing that just got said there, and I do have a little chuckle to myself because this person has said it on numerous occasions before, right?
Yeah.
I think my journey has come to an end. I'm going to be where I am. If you know her as well as you know what we've learned, to you know, me personally, and I know Emily knows Ali a lot, her phone hasn't stopped ringing and still hasn't stopped ringing since the time she said that she was going to do stuff with Craig. But she's sitting here telling you,
have you noticed her username?
Please leave me alone.
So, let's just say. I've got a sneaky suspicion that there's a big, big future ahead for not only for young Ali in the top left-hand corner, but for Madam in the bottom right-hand corner and Emily as well. I think there's a massive future for both of these two young ladies. Because
but the thing is about that mentorship that Ali was talking about, when I qualified first and I was trying to get into football, I wrote to every football club in the country, like every football club in the country, from grassroots up to like Man City. And asking for work experience. Sorry, Sarah, to drive you up the wall altogether. But these clubs have the facilities to give you experience. Mm-hmm. But Chris Morgan, the Liverpool physio, was lovely and stayed in touch with me and like said to me, these are the courses you need to do, this is what you need to do. And Jason Palmer, who was at Chelsea at the time, used to ring me every other week. What have you done this week? What have you done? Talk to me about your week. Tell me what you've done. And I just write everything down. I found that the hardest. And like, it was really comforting to have that. But then obviously they get busy. Their lives go different ways. But I thought that's a really special thing to have when you're starting out, because they are here.
Yeah.
I was here. And I was lucky during lockdown as well. Chris, who's the physio at Dover, took me for a little bit of work experience to like keep me busy. And I learned a lot of him, and I learned a lot about the National League, that grounds are very far to travel when you've got pleural pain. Absolutely. And you sit on a coach for 5 hours. I 100% agree with Ali. A mentorship scheme would be fantastic.
I think it's certain that the Isthmian League can really promote, because I think they can say, like, you know what, we have like these many young people, we want to get them doing, or even if doing different sports or doing trade-offs. I think that Nick would have a really good profile to do that for us a little bit, rather than me just bothering the West Ham physio for hours on end and applying to Arsenal and then not getting replied back to and then longing it off because I'm, you know.
But then I think like you could just not limit it to football. So
yeah.
For me, like if I go back to what I wanted to do, like I knew I wasn't going to get there. I didn't know people in football. I was like, this isn't achievable, but I knew I still wanted to get to high level. I wanted to work internationally. That was it. So I just had to diversify. So I just went for the rugby stuff. I then, you know, got the judo stuff. I did Commonwealth Games. I do work hockey now, and I've ended up doing a bit of like, you know, England work for hockey as well, like for the under 18s and under 16s. And I think it's also taking your chances on other sports. And I think the problem is you do see a lot of like, you know, you see it on Twitter and you see a lot of people who just fixate on football. And I do appreciate this is a football chat. Completely get it.
I'm going to look you off and carry on.
I think actually to become a not a better clinician, but maybe a more rounded clinician is to go and look at other sports. Because if you did like, you know, I would say then my spinal stuff, the way I managed that, I learned that all through judo. So I would be really confident having a spinal injury, I could manage that no problem on a hockey pitch, rugby pitch, fine. And then, it, you know, I hated doing all my respiratory training in like when I was a, you know, a physio, like in at the London hospital.
You're going to say a proper physio? Were you going to say a proper physio?
Got me married, X, Y, and Z. And I think it's a good idea to, one, get this mentorship thing, but then look at other sports to provide that mentorship as well. Because there are some really good physios out there who work in athletics, who work in rugby or boxing or wherever. And they would take people on, but just because they're not in your sport, I don't necessarily think that's a barrier, because sport is sport, and it's how you manage a team or how you manage an individual. The rehab, you can learn. You can go on courses to learn rehab, that's fine. But actually managing the dynamics within a team, you can pick that up, I think, from any sport, to be perfectly honest with you.
I think, Sarah, if I could do my career again, I know I'm not, my career is nowhere near its end, to be honest, let's be honest. The hospital stuff that's coming up, hopefully. But I think that if I could do my sports career again, I'd have done a bit more like what you've done, I think, in hindsight. I look up to you a lot, Sarah. You know this anyway.
So kind of you. That's so
only because you're taller than me.
That's, you know, that's part of it. But I, coming back to you, David, what you were saying about like Ali's phone going off for her, I can completely understand it. You know, I follow, not in a weird sporty way, but I follow you on Twitter, I see what's going on, and I see, you know, how you kind of promote yourself through there. And you've obviously got a lot of respect in your lower league clubs. And I think you could take that on to like the Prem or Championship or whatever. I think the thing that sometimes holds people back when they get to a certain level of physio, rehab, a therapist, and then they see the wage structure, and I know it shouldn't all be about wages, but you need to think about it. You need to be able to pay your rent. You need to be able to put petrol in your car, all this sort of thing. And when you look at some of these academy jobs that come up and you know what they're after and you see the pay, and you're like, but these two just don't equate. So I think sometimes that's what holds like maybe more experienced physios back from going for those posts, because they know, well, actually I can make a bit more money privately, or I can just stick in the NHS. So I think sometimes that because the wage structure isn't quite there, I think people do lose out on your clubs lose out on really good therapists, basically, because they're not willing to pay for them. I think that's it.
Well, ladies, I'll tell you what.
I'm going to be honest, Dave. You might have to keep this rolling, mate. This is going so well. Can we have another 10 minutes? Go on, David. You know you want to. Go on, David. Because I've got to ask Sarah one more big question. Because I'll be honest, obviously, my work now goes into what I would call Sunday League, which, let's be real, Sarah, that's going to be crazy, hasn't it? Especially on my Instagram. We won't talk about that right now. But what I've noticed in the last sort of 2 weeks, we've had what I know of, and there's probably more, at least 5 ruptured tendons, which in my 12 years of physio, something like that, I've probably seen 1 or 2, and they were in particular circumstances. So I know there's been a bit of an epidemic in, hopefully it's rained, it'll be better now, of Achilles going, but also sort of patellar tendons. You're hot on tendons, Sarah. I know you're good at tendons. You're an MSK figure in my background.
Yeah, I'm not bad at them. I've done a couple of courses. I do really like them. I don't mind Achilles and knee, that patella tendon stuff. Hamstrings still, you know, get away from me in some way. But I think that the problem is, I think if you just look at where we are globally at the moment, we're in a pandemic and we've just come out of, excuse my language, a really shitty lockdown. Like, I think the third lockdown was actually one of the hardest. It was long, long, wintry, cold nights. People didn't really want to go out. They've just got a little bit more deconditioned. And, you know, you've had that kind of bout before Christmas where people could get back to the gym, and then all of a sudden they just had to stop. And it's been a really horrible stopping period. And then all of a sudden you're like, right, let's get going again, guys. It's like, well, that's brilliant. And then I was reading about the stuff. So I was waiting to see what happened with hockey, and we voided our season. But I was watching like what the football side of it was going to do. And they're like, yeah, we're going to shove all these games in this one short period. And I'm like, well, yeah, your tendons are going to go at that point. Absolutely. Because what you've done there is you've just put too much load through the tendon. So, well, without bamboozling you with science, tendons are pressure gauges. So if you put too much pressure through there, it's going to try and get the muscle to contract to relax. If that muscle just can't cope with it, the tendon's going to help out, but it'll help out to the point where it potentially can tear and then rupture, like it goes. So if you just don't have that strength through there, then it is a perfect storm, and you've got hard grounds that also happening, which isn't great. And then all of a sudden you've gone from a load of doing nothing to doing everything. And I think you may have had a lot of people coming back into like just running, you know, or playing football, whatever, but not actually doing like the strength and conditioning stuff or the underlying kind of strengthening stuff that you wanted to have been doing over those past 3 months, because even that probably wouldn't have been enough. You wouldn't have been able to put enough load through that tendon to really, really push it. So I think it is all about, like, you know, that strength and conditioning element that you need. And I think that's the reason why so many tenders are gone, because people are just desperate to get out. They're desperate to play. They're desperate to see one another. And they, if they were honest with themselves, they're probably saying, oh, I'm not quite fit enough here. Or they will be feeling something. Like your Achilles just doesn't, you can feel stuff. Like something's going on. Your calf's just got that little bit tighter. Your quad's got that little bit tighter. But you're thinking, no, it's all right. I just haven't done any exercise for a while. And then all of a sudden it goes. So it's that sort of thing. And it's that load, it's that internal load, whether it's you put on a little bit of weight, it's going to happen. You've got a little bit deconditioned, or you've decided to buy some fancy new shoes, or you've decided to really up from doing no running to running 5K five times a week. It's that load. And that's when the tendon just gets really, really unhappy. And unfortunately, if your tendon goes, like, depending on how it goes, it's surgery. You could be out for 6 to 9 months, you know, depending on where it is.
Yeah.
So I think then the sports have a responsibility to be, you know, sensible with this and not just say to them, oh, you know, you've got to fill in all these games in this point. It's like, no, don't start doing that, because then it is, you know, unfortunately, it does keep me in work, I'm going to be honest, but that's...
paying my mortgage for your FM, mate. I mean, it is what it is.
It is. That, you know, players should be put in that position as well. Absolutely. And then when it comes to tendon management, it's like people are developing Achilles tendon or tendon problems or patella tendon problems. It's not necessarily what you're doing in that rehab session that you have there and then. It's all about what you're doing outside of it. So are you putting the Achilles on a stretch? If you're sitting in a position where you're, you know, crunched up all day and you've got your Achilles on a massive stretch the whole time, are you doing lots of running and jumping that's aggravating it? Or are you walking around in bare feet? Bare feet aggravates an Achilles tendon. Be in trainers, be in flip-flops, that sort of thing.
They're basically bastards, Achilles tendon. I hate them more than I hate hamstrings. They're
I'm such a geek. I love
from my language and body back. They're absolute pricks.
Oh, I love them. I love them so much.
She's gone in hard, lads. She's gone in hard.
Oh, they're honestly. When you hear that, you go, oh, that's a tendon. You go, oh, no, that's 9 months out, kid. Sorry. And you always tell them when a little tear goes down a little face. Like, I'm sorry. No, this is not a good injury. You're going for surgery this week, probably, Dad. Sorry.
I mean, maybe nice don't break it to them quite like that, if I'm honest. Like, oh, surgery. You know, as you move more across the pitch, don't do that.
I think you do that, Sarah. That's
and I shimmy in and go, surgery. Yeah. I wasn't quite that brutal, but poor guy, I happened to, it's always been against, never the Dons, always touch wood, always against the Dons, and poor guy went down, he heard it, went, okay, that's a tendon, went on there, got him off, and I was like, oh, okay. His manager went, oh, don't worry, mate, are you back in 2 weeks? Maybe not 2 weeks, and then maybe a bit longer. He said, maybe a couple of 6 months. Said, but you never know, I might be wrong. I don't think I am.
Crack you off, though, when you're assessing an injury and a manager comes over your shoulder going, well, mate, at this very same injury, you'll be fine in 4 weeks.
Yeah. I say, well...
I don't know what the injury is yet, mate. Can you go away, please?
I don't know. I think you know an Achilles when it goes. You get a lovely little snap, the snap of doom, I like to call it.
But it's then like, it's making sure like you try and, you know, help players out, whether it's a strengthening program, whether you do it or they go to a PT in a gym. Like, I don't care. Whatever they need to do to get themselves strong, but it's got to be like, you know, a loaded program. It's a progressive program as well. That's the key. And I think, like I say, I unfortunately it has been a bit of a perfect storm these last, you know, last year, let's be honest. But I think this like I say, that last lockdown, it was just long, and then all of a sudden everyone's just desperate to get back. So like, I knew there was going to be injuries. Like within one or two weeks I was starting to get phone calls on my triage line of, oh, I've done this, and I was like, yeah, what have you been doing for the past 3 months? Oh, I've just been sitting in my chair on spreadsheets. And I was like, yeah, well, that's the issue, is you've just not moved. But so I think there needs to be a little bit of leeway on this. And I mean, in hockey, we've managed to get back to some kind of training and like friendly games, and we'll be stopping in the next couple of weeks. But we've kind of built it up slowly. I mean, it has got harder and harder because our coach, Quan Brown, is, you know, he's a tough cookie, and he makes our guys, yeah, exactly. He makes our guys work really hard, but he, you know, he works hard himself as well.
He's an Olympian, isn't he, Sarah?
I don't think he went to Commonwealth Games. So this guy, Quan Brown, he's our manager of Hampstead and Westminster. So he currently works with the GB men's squad. So they're hoping, like, I think he may be going to Tokyo if it happens. And he's been working with like our elite development program as well. And he's obviously like our coach, but he was a international hockey player for Trinidad and Tobago, and I think he only quit last year before. I think he was 41 when he quit. I'm not being funny. I don't think I've seen a fitter person in my entire life. Like, he's a machine. I think somewhere on my Twitter, I'll put you in there, his Quan's aerobics that he gets our players sometimes to do. I think I've got it on a beach in Barcelona when we managed to make the Euros. So he got them doing Quan's Quan's aerobics on the beach. And that was quite interesting. But he's just so enthusiastic, and like, you know, he works really hard, and our lads work really hard. And when I first started at Hampstead, it was a very different setup, and then he came in, changed everything around with like Hugh Stevens was the assistant coach as well, and that's how I've had to adapt, because he was just at that level, and I was like, well, I've got to get up that level as well then. And I think that's how I've then progressed as a physio as well, is just being around people that just work, you know, tirelessly and work so hard, and you think, well, I've got to match this. And you know, and we eventually got to Europe a couple of seasons ago, and the best way to describe it is like the Champions League of hockey. And that was like a proper box ticking moment for me. In Barcelona, we were playing a Dutch team, and I think there is a picture of me on Twitter with my massive moon face, having a big old smile, and I've got a Britney Spears headphone on it as well. But I was like, this is what I want to do, this is amazing. But it's taken quite a few years to get there. And I am a bit of a journeyman, I guess, if you're looking at a football equivalent of, like, you know, wandering through the sports and everything. But that's pretty much where it's...
I think I would say, though, Sarah, your experience on a personal level was second to none. I think you're the physio that I go to when I've got a problem.
Right, because you're the physio I go to when I have
exactly. A problem. Exactly. It sounds funny, but Sarah's the woman I go to. But when our players are struggling, whenever I think of, oh, this physio, no, it's Sarah, 100%. She doesn't do football, but you know what? She does injuries beautifully.
It's when Can I steal you as a mentor, please?
Absolutely. No, you can't.
Not a problem.
Tara! You know what, mate? That's it. No more gin for you. And you know what? It's your birthday on Tuesday. So you know what?
It's my birthday on Tuesday.
You know what? I've cancelled it.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
21 again, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, ladies, thank you very much. Ladies, it's been a fantastic almost hour and a half now. So it really has been a fantastic chat tonight. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. I really have. And Sarah, please don't be a stranger. Please come back and join us again.
We'd love to have you back.
Come back with our new mentee.
Yeah, no problems. I'd love to come back. I've had so much fun. Thank you so much for the invite.
It was a pleasure having you, Sarah. Thank you.
And just for me, a few things to say. Of course, tonight is the last one of our series, but it's one person I suppose we should be saying thank you to as well, because he does watch the show week in, week out. Gets very disappointed when the show's not on. And Dan, me and the girls all like to say a massive, massive thank you to you for your following, for your presence. And mate, keep yourself well. And don't forget that if you need anything while we're off air, you can contact any of us, and we'll be there for you, mate. Not a problem as you're there for us. But also as well, a massive thank you to the two ladies, and of course Courtney, who couldn't make it with us tonight. These ladies are absolutely top class. Let me tell you, they were nervous to start doing it. Ali and Emily and Courtney, I've got nothing but admiration for all three of you. You are absolutely fantastic. Really looking forward to August when we get back together again on a Friday night for more of the Effing Bag Show. And guys, if you need a physio, there's two here or three here. They're absolutely fantastic. To make sure you do, because these young ladies are absolutely top, top class.
Hey, but I want to retire. I'm putting it out there. Stop telling people to bring me up.
And please, all I shall say to you is, girls, please do not put yourselves down. There is a massive, massive future in physiotherapy and football and whatever you want to do for you two ladies. You are absolutely sensational. And you know it is. So stop putting yourself down, young Ali at the top, because Premier League is calling, and for you, young lady at the bottom as well.
I have my hand up.
Go on, mate.
I think the real thank you needs to go to you, the founder of the F and Bag Show. Thank you for making it possible, because you've got all the equipment. Me and Ali just show up.
We just turn up and have a drink, basically.
Oh, it's water tonight. But honestly, Dave, thanks a million, because it's this podcast has got me through lockdown massively. Something to look forward to. I've really enjoyed Ali's company. Obviously, I've known her for forever and ever and ever, it feels like. And thanks a million to you, Dave, because you've made it possible.
No, thank you. And I say, girls, if it's something you want to do during the off season, exactly the same as we do with Keith. If there's any big things drop, then we want to do a special. We'll do specials. We can do a special here and there.
When Ali finds her new club, we'll do a big announcement.
I'm at a club. I'm at the Dons. What's bigger than that, eh?
But listen, I know the girls don't like me doing it, but I will do it. There is the last in the series of the D&K Reposh Show. That is on Monday night with me and Keith. And joining me and Keith on Monday night will be the FA Bars winning manager. He will be with us, and director of football from Heaven. Yeah, will be with us, and hopefully they'll still be in this year's competition when we speak to him on Monday. And of course, also as well, they've got a big event coming up very, very soon as well in the FA Trophy. And the boys from Hornchurch will also,
it's Barry McGuigan!
will also be with us, as well as the manager from Seven Oaks, Mickey Collins, will also be with us as well. So join me and Keith at 7 till 9 on Monday night. But until then, until August, thank you, girls. Thank you, Sarah, for being with us tonight.
No problem.
We'll see you all
in
August.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night.